Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at viking.com.
From the Wall Street Journal, this is Instant Message. I'm David Pierce. This week on the show, we're going to dig into everything Apple said this week about its recent quarter, its plans for TV, and what comes after the iPhone. Later on, I'll be chatting with Jason Gay, our sports columnist, who's going to tell us what to watch for at the Super Bowl this weekend, which he goes to, as you'll find out, and talk through how the way we all watch sports and TV and everything is changing. We'll also have a quick tip for staying safe, which is, spoiler alert, turn off FaceTime. More on that later. First up, another week, another crazy Facebook privacy scandal. This time, paying teens to scrape data from their phones, strangely enough. This one has led to a battle with Apple that could have huge ramifications for both companies. So joining to help me explain what in the world is going on between Facebook and Apple and a bunch of teens, Christopher Mims. Joanna's on vacation this week and is thus dead to us. Okay, so Christopher, can you explain what actually is happening here? Because I feel like there's this long-standing sort of privacy feud between Facebook and Apple that is blowing up in sort of non-obvious to regular human ways, but might bubble over into that. Can you just like, where did this all start? How is this happening?
The privacy feud between Facebook and Apple has been personal for a long time. I mean, Tim Cook has been giving interviews since I think 2017 at least, where he has said that, you know, Facebook is a major problem. He just wrote a cover story for Time saying that, you know, companies like Facebook are harvesting our data and weaponizing it. It was confirmed by Facebook at some point in the past that Mark Zuckerberg ordered his lieutenants to stop using iPhones. It's unclear whether or not this was in response to Tim Cook's comments, but the timing is certainly suspicious. So there has been this very personal battle between Tim Cook at Apple saying that this is a harm to our democracy, to our society, and Mark Zuckerberg being dismissive and saying, basically, I disagree with Tim Cook. And oh, by the way, iPhones and Apple are for rich people. We are for everyone who can't afford to pay for things. And, you know, that justifies our ad model.
Okay. But it always seemed like they were sort of at an impasse, the two companies, because you have Apple, which makes the iPhone. And if Facebook doesn't have the iPhone, suddenly there's a giant audience of people who can't use Facebook. And then on the other side, Facebook's apps are like the most popular thing on the iPhone. Between, you know, WhatsApp, Instagram, and Facebook, I think you have three of like the six most popular apps in the App Store. So these companies need each other, but then all of a sudden this week, it became real. The basic story as I understand it, and please add to this because you know more than I do, is that Facebook was running a thing called Facebook Research. And it was basically an app where they were paying people $20 a month to give them all of their data about what they were doing on their phone. And you had to opt in and you had to download the app, but this was all happening outside of the App Store because that sort of thing, which is an app that runs and collects all your data about everything you do on your phone, actually goes against Apple's policies. So Facebook used a tool that is designed for internal use to get people to download this app, and Facebook was doing this and Apple freaked out. Is that roughly correct?
That's correct. The nuance we should add is that Google was doing the same thing. The moment that they saw Apple freak out about this, ended their own app, which used the exact same tool. It's called a developer certification. It's intended only for companies to distribute apps internally to their companies, not to consumers. That was Facebook's violation of the terms and conditions. However, as we know, Apple did not respond by revoking Google's developer certificate, which would have caused mayhem inside the company, has apparently caused of Facebook, even though Sheryl Sandberg gave an interview saying, oh, it's business as usual, we're okay, but what else would we expect her to say? So, you know, sources inside Facebook have said reliably that this has done everything from make it so Facebookers can't get a bus using an internal app, to can't see the menu that day, to cannot download or operate betas for their main apps like Facebook and Instagram.
So in that, because rather than just shut down this one app, right, Apple basically went to Facebook and said, your certificate that you have through our developer services is now revoked. And that means all the internal apps that they just give to employees, all the things they use to test new versions of apps, all of that is now impossible, right? They have no way to put non-App Store apps on the iPhone anymore.
I honestly feel like it's kind of unprecedented. I mean, the last thing I can think of this was there was some a few years ago, there was some little piece of code that it turned out everyone on the web was making a call on. And the guy who developed it, in a fit of pique, deleted it, and like half the internet broke. And everyone was like, guys, we really should not be dependent on other companies for our code to work like this. That's the last time I could think of a precedent. I can't think of any time, though, where a company said to another company, like, we have this awesome power over your ability to make things, and we are going to exercise it now. Like, that is, it went from a cold war between these two companies, a war of words, to a shooting war. And Apple demonstrated an incredible amount of power in this process.
Yeah. So, and that's where this gets weird for me. So I don't know how comfortable I am or should be with the idea that Apple has this kind of power over Facebook. And I feel like I've always sort of known that that's a thing that exists, but I've never seen it wielded like this. Like it went from Apple, you know, this big company saying we take a stance that goes against these other big companies, to saying like, no, we are going to now materially affect your business, Facebook. Google did the same thing, but we're going to leave them alone because they were nicer about it. And like we are now in charge of regulating the privacy of iPhone users. And maybe it had to be that way, but it just feels weird that this is how it is now.
It is strange that Tim Cook is now the privacy sheriff. On the other hand, we are in a strange situation in other ways. It is a little bit bizarre that the FTC has not come down on Facebook yet in the wake of, you know, what are now old scandals around privacy. You know, on the other hand, in their defense, I just talked to a law professor who's an expert in this, who said this is as complicated as the Mueller investigation, because there's so many moving pieces, they can't get it wrong. If they get it wrong and a judge says, no, you didn't prove your case, they don't really get a do-over. So, you know, the FTC is in a difficult position. It's not clear whether it's a lack of aggressiveness on their part. We have no federal privacy law. The California privacy law doesn't take effect till 2020. It's probably going to be watered down between now and then. So I think Tim Cook, who has shown himself to be a very vocally moral CEO, whether the issue is the environment or, you know, LGBT rights, I honestly don't know. I have no insider information, but I think that Cook as a CEO and Apple as a company said, we are going to be the privacy cop now. Like, Facebook has finally stepped over the line. We're going to do something that will materially damage them, because they made a clear violation of our terms and conditions. And so we're within our rights. You know, it's not like they woke up one day and just deleted the Facebook app off of the App Store. That would have been truly a bridge too far.
Wait, but why? Isn't that just, you know, if this really is Apple being the privacy cop, to say we're going to leave Facebook on our platform, and by extension to say we're going to stop taking billions of dollars from Google to let it be the search engine in Safari, and why aren't those the next steps? Like, how can Apple go this far and not go all the way?
Maybe those are the next steps. I don't know. Nobody knows, right?
That's scary.
I agree with you. I think if you were to try to map some of Tim Cook's public statements to what many apps on his device do, there's a gap between those two, and there's a certain amount of hypocrisy. You know, if they are going to really stand on principle here, it feels like they would have to do more. Now, obviously, in the corporate world, it's all about real politics, right? It's like geopolitics. I mean, these really are like nation states negotiating with one another. So Tim Cook comes out and he takes a really strong position, you know, like, we are going to eliminate you from our platform. We're going to impose these harsh tariffs. And then Facebook comes back with some other, you know, it's a negotiation. I really think it is truly a negotiation between these companies. And the horrifying thing to me as a member of what is still ostensibly a democracy is none of us have a say. We are not participating in this.
Right. Well, and that's the weird part, is that we're just bystanders in this thing that is actually going to affect us in gigantic, everyday, personal ways. I mean, Apple has to know that getting rid of Facebook would mean a lot of people would stop using iPhones. I think that's pretty straightforward. But there's a world in which Apple decides on moral grounds that that's worth it to some extent. I don't know. And like, it is weird that we have no idea where this is going to land and no control over it, and that it's just behemoth companies making these decisions that affect our lives forever.
Yeah, it's a really odd chapter. And I think what is coming are many more chapters that revolve around, you know, FTC action, actual regulation from California and from the feds eventually. I mean, Tim Cook has called for privacy regulation repeatedly. Like, I mean, he calls up Congress people and says, you have to do this. So this may also be Apple trying to leverage this. I mean, the final point, though, being cynical about this is, you know, we're at a point now where surveys reveal that, you know, people just assume that Facebook is going to do possibly shady things with their data or that they don't have privacy on Facebook. I mean, Apple is still touting itself as the privacy company. Apple has to continue to maintain that image. And this is a really great way to generate a ton of free press for themselves. Right after there was a big bug in FaceTime that would violate your privacy, and right after some bad numbers on the last quarter. I'm not saying that these things are necessarily all connected, but this is a nice little moment for Apple to both stick a poke a stick in the eye of Facebook and earn some brownie points for protecting our collective privacy.
Yeah, it is deeply good timing that on the heels of a lot of bad news for Apple, it gets to be the knight in shining armor here.
Yeah.
Well played on their part. Although it does seem like being on the other side of Facebook is pretty much always a key to getting good press, because there's a Facebook scandal every 45 minutes. So you just invent a new one and you're good to go.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to run out of Facebook privacy scandals. I mean, at this point, I think that it is a beast that feeds on itself, because as others have pointed out to me, every media research company under the sun, so, you know, Kantar, Nielsen, Compete, ComScore, they all run services that slurp up all of your data. You sign up for them, you get paid money, they slurp up all your data on your desktop and on your mobile device. You know, in the next 48 hours, we might discover that one of them was using the developer certification program to get this onto people's phones as well. Or we might not. It might be a VPN app that was essentially, quote unquote, going through the front door and was approved by Apple. But they all do this. The only reason that we are freaking out about it is that it is Facebook and people do not trust them. So Facebook, when they had their earlier VPN app, which is Onavo, which is an acquisition, banned from Apple's App Store, had the option to go to a Nielsen or a ComScore and just be like, hey, run this panel for us. We need this data, the same data that this app is gathering for them. I mean, maybe not quite as comprehensive, and give themselves some plausible deniability. But, you know, Facebook is, we're a big, powerful company. We can spend $20 to $40 million a year on this, acquiring people and paying them to give us their data. Let's just do it. It's hubris. You know, at some point, they're going to have a Microsoft moment where they get scared and spend a few years being careful. But I think what's happening over and over and over again, we are finding out things that Facebook has been doing for years that suddenly are in a new light. You know, if not for the Cambridge Analytica stuff, nobody would even care about this at this point.
Yeah. And it's not insignificant that this stuff only keeps getting found out because it gets reported on, not because Apple is discovering it or Facebook is admitting it. It's like, these things are just out there. And even Facebook over and over has said, you know, yeah, we're doing this. It's not,
yes, this
unclear
app has
what
existed
we're doing. People
for
opt
years.
In. It's like, this is just the world.
Yeah, it's not a secret. It's somebody finally noticed and reported on it.
All right. Well, you have a story to write, which is going to be live by the time anybody listens to this. So go write it. Thank you for being here. Good luck.
Yes. Thank you.
This week, Apple reported its quarterly earnings, which matter generally a lot to investors, but not much to normal humans. But this one earnings report, along with the conference call that came after, actually had a lot to say about Apple's future and what's coming next in tech generally. Joining me for this one are Apple reporter Trip Mickle. 3 weeks ago, Apple comes out and says, we had a bad quarter. The numbers are going to look bad when we report them in 3 weeks. And then this week, they reported said numbers, right? Was anything surprising in what Apple reported? There was they gave a bunch of bad news and then just repeated the news.
They ripped the Band-Aid 4/5 of the way off and finished the tear this week. Essentially, that's what happened,
Band-Aid.
Right? Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there was a little left behind the curtain that they hadn't quite revealed, which was performance in geographies beyond China and some specificity around, you know, how far did iPhone sales dip. The iPhone business is so big that it doesn't necessarily matter that there's growth in everything else, right? So, like, you know, the big takeaway is when you see sales drop in the iPhone, even if they have tremendous growth in their other areas of business, which include the Mac, iPad, wearables, that doesn't necessarily make up for a decline in iPhone.
Okay. And that, I mean, all the news that was not about the iPhone was good news, right? Like services is growing, which is iCloud and whatever else they extract from the App Store and stuff like that. The Mac, didn't they say they had the best Mac quarter ever?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly Mac, iPad, services, wearables, they're all growing. I mean, they had hinted at that before. You know, in the case of the iPad and the Mac, you have to look at those and say, well, they certainly benefited from the same strategy Apple took with the iPhone a year earlier where they took up price.
So, okay. And so the other thing that I thought was interesting is Tim Cook in the call they did with investors actually talked about more than I expected was the TV stuff. I had never actually sort of heard him put together all the pieces in one thing. And like, you kind of realize, at least it struck me, that Apple is actually building a TV product already, like kind of in front of our eyes, right? Like he made the point that they have AirPlay 2, which is working on lots of TVs, so you'll be able to stream stuff to TVs. They have these new subscription channels. They have original content that they don't really want to talk about yet. And they have the Apple TV. So it's like the pieces are starting to be there. Why is this such a big deal for Apple? It's like, it makes sense to me that everybody would be interested in the success of the Apple Watch and trying to figure out what comes after the iPhone. But like the next iPhone for Apple is not TV shows starring Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon.
No, but they recognize that they're not going to necessarily sell more of these devices. You're going to be in a period where they're looking to sell about 200 million of them a year, which is a lot, right?
It's a crazy number.
It's a crazy number, right? So as long as they do that, they're going to be, you know, generally fine. Sure. But in order to find growth, they can't take up iPhone prices again because they're already facing challenges. So now where do you find growth? Well, the best prospect is funneling things across the device, selling people more things across the device along the lines of Netflix or along the lines of what we saw Amazon offer that made Prime more interesting.
Yeah, so the Prime thing is really interesting to me because it seems like there's a world in which that's where Apple goes, where they have Apple News, which there have been talks of them doing a like subscription thing with Apple News. There's Apple Music. There's iCloud. There's a rumor going around that they're doing a game streaming service, which who knows? There are rumors about everything.
They have talked about that internally. Okay. Yes, certainly.
And then there's going to be this TV thing. And so whatever that is, it doesn't seem crazy to me that they would be like, okay, it's $25 a month and you get all of these things. And then the goal is like make it more and more worthwhile. Was it on the analyst call that Tim Cook called out Oprah specifically?
Yes.
That felt very telling to me that that's the flagship thing that he's so excited about is that they have a multi-year deal with Oprah.
Yes.
I feel like that says a lot about what Apple's up to.
Yes. Yeah, no, certainly. And may indicate like that was one that Tim personally wanted to be involved with.
I mean, I guess that's true. She's made a lot of money for a lot of people basically everywhere she's ever tried. So it's
she's
could
Oprah.
Do a lot worse. Yeah, she's Oprah. Exactly. And you've also been reporting on all this privacy stuff around like what's going on with Facebook this week. And I was reading a stat this morning that said something like 90% of people plan to keep their operating system when they get a new phone. And it's like iPhone users remain iPhone users and Android users remain Android users. But like, I guess that's true. As more people care about privacy, Apple is going to try to be the one that sits there and says like, no, there's a better way. Come over here. And like cameras won't do it. Everybody has good cameras. All the apps are the same. They're like Android and iOS are like functionally the same in most important ways. But Apple can keep banging this drum that says like, we'll keep you safe, which I'm not convinced matters yet to most people, but maybe it will over time.
Yeah. And I think if that becomes a point of differentiation, I think all of this is going to be fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sitting here with an iPhone and an Apple Watch and an iPad all in front of me. So I feel like they're going to be fine.
you like your privacy.
Apparently. I'm going to get to Jason Gay and the Super Bowl in a second. But while we're on the subject of privacy, users discovered a big bug in Apple's FaceTime app this week. Basically, here's how it works. When you call someone on FaceTime, you can hear their audio and in some cases even see their video before they even pick up. It kind of turns FaceTime into an accidental spying device. Apple did acknowledge the bug and says it's fixing it, but until it does, you should turn off FaceTime. Go to settings on all your devices, tap on FaceTime, and toggle the switch to off. And when you do see an update, which hopefully is coming soon, install it as soon as you can. It's a pretty scary bug. Anyway, next up is my interview with Jason Gay to talk about the way we watch sports and how it's changing.
ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kinda heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
In happier news, this weekend is the Super Bowl. Patriots versus Rams in Atlanta. Patriots quarterback Tom Brady is really good. Rams coach Sean McVay is really young. Lots of interesting stories in this game. But I'm less interested in the football part of it and more in the how we watch football part of it. The Super Bowl is the biggest TV event of the year and is thus a good time to talk about the way we watch sports and how it's changing. Here to talk about that is Jason Gay, the Journal sports columnist. Jason, if I'm not mistaken, you spent the last week or so in Colorado watching a bunch of people ride bikes in the snow. So I don't know if you know this, but the Super Bowl is this weekend?
Yeah, there's a football game, a big North American football game on Sunday.
Are you in Atlanta?
In Atlanta,
right now?
Georgia.
Are you in Atlanta?
I'm not. I'm not going until tomorrow. See, the thing is, Pierce, when you get to be a big shot like your buddy Jason, you don't have to spend the whole week there. Like, you know those people who like dress up like giraffes and wander around on Monday interviewing players? I'm out of that league, man. I don't have to do that anymore. I just take
the
private jet. I take the Gulfstream. I take the Dow Jones Gulfstream, and I just go on down to Georgia and waltz right into the stadium.
And then they let you play a couple of snaps, and then... And then you call it a Super Bowl.
I priced out of that, too. I can't take any contact anymore, David.
Okay, so what I want to talk to you about is basically the way that we watch the Super Bowl. I feel like the football part of it is whatever. The Patriots are very good. The Rams, less good, but still pretty good. And that's all you need to know. But it seems like we're in this position where everything about how we watch sports and TV in general is changing. And we have, like, legalized gambling is becoming a thing. Fantasy is becoming a thing. I don't know. You might have heard this. But where, like, what are you thinking about sort of as you think about Super Bowl parties and being at the game? And, like, what's different about Super Bowl Sunday than it used to be a few years ago?
Well, it's an excellent question and a great topic. And, candidly, I haven't been to a Super Bowl party in quite a long time because I've been going to the game. Again, Pierce, I'm a big shot. That's what I'm trying to say. So I don't go, you know, riffraff like you has to go to Super Bowl parties. I'm actually at the game. But I have some thoughts about this topic, nevertheless. I think where things have changed is that the Super Bowl was this, you know, shared viewing experience. It was not considered terribly social to just watch the Super Bowl by oneself. And even if you're not a football fan, it's likely you're going to find a couple of people to hang out and watch the game with on Sunday. And so it's this shared experience where you sit there and you know, ooh and ah about plays or laugh at the commercials and make some jokes about Tom Brady's avocado ice cream diet and so on. And that's a fun thing to do. But I feel where technology has changed things is that virtually everything now today is a shared viewing experience. It doesn't matter if it's a mass event like the Super Bowl, which has 110 million viewers, or the most like arcane like cable show or something on Netflix. You are going to be able to find like-minded people to share that experience with, often in real time. So I feel that it's this whole virtual change that has happened in television viewing, where you're able to share it with people, many of whom are strangers. But then at the same time, you have this almost anachronistic thing where people are in the same room, you know, sharing Doritos and, you know, warm beer and watching it together. So those parallel tracks are kind of strange right now.
Okay. Well, and what's interesting to me about that is it feels like we're at this position where with a lot of TV and, you know, video game streaming and this new stuff, that they're leaning into that stuff where it's like, okay, let's figure out how to put this on Twitch and let people see that. And, you know, let's add it to Twitter and have hashtags and make it a big deal that everybody can talk about it. But the Super Bowl feels like when the Super Bowl goes that way, that's it. That's when we've officially turned into a new media age. And, I would guess that if I'm the executives at CBS, I am trying to delay that day as long as possible.
Yes and no. I mean, I think that they are, you know, first of all, they now stream the game, which they were reluctant to do for a long time because they didn't want to have any erosion of that, you know, big Nielsen number they're accustomed to getting. I just think the game retains a massive amount of value, both from a dollar perspective. CBS is charging $5 million for a commercial spot during this year's game, which is just outrageous. $10 million if you want to run a 1 minute spot during this game. I think the game has incredible value. I think that it what's happened at the same time that, you know, tastes have changed and technology has changed is that very, very few things endure as this communal viewing experience. And live sport, because you got to see it when you see it. It's not the kind of thing you can watch on DVD or DVR, rather, a few days later. Just has, you know, a great grip and real value to the people who are airing it. So, I don't think that they're warding off technology, because this thing has proven to be rather technology proof.
Okay. At some point, one of us needs to find somebody who watches the Super Bowl on DVD and just get to know them really, really well. I have a lot of questions for that person.
I know, right? There have to be a few of them. There have to be people. I mean, I always think, like, look, 2/3 of the country is not actually watching the Super Bowl, if you believe that, you know, 100 million figure.
That's true. It sounds like a smaller number when you put it like that.
Yeah.
What are they doing? What is there to do on Super Bowl Sunday?
They're sleeping and they're reading your column, maybe at the same time.
That's all I ask. So the commercials thing I love, because it struck me this week that by the time we get to Super Bowl Sunday, we are going to have seen pretty much all of the ads, because they end up on YouTube.
I know, right?
In the week before.
Yeah.
And then so it's like, okay, I'm going to see all the ads before, and then I could just sit on Instagram and see the highlights as I go. So like, I could effectively pretend I watched the Super Bowl on Monday without actually spending any time watching it on Sunday.
Yes, you could do that. That would make you strange, but I think you could pull it off. I think that I live in a building where a couple of ad people are. You know, there are a couple of I have neighbors who are in the ad business, and no one's quite explained to my liking the why they just release these commercials way, way in advance. You're just sucking all the drama out of, you know, the big reveal after that first commercial break in the Super Bowl. Who's it going to be? What's it going to be? And if we've all seen the spots before they happen, and the big one this week, I think, was the kind of god-awful Big Lebowski Sex and the City mashup ad with Jeff Bridges and Sarah Jessica Parker. You know, what's left? One thing that's true about being at the game, and David, did I tell you I always go to the Super Bowl? I always do. One thing that about being at the game, you miss a huge part of what America's cultural experience is about the Super Bowl. You don't see the commercials. Like, we're not sitting there, you know, being able to process what these things are about. And so you see all this chatter that's happening on Twitter and other social media about, oh my God, that thing was so terrible, or that was great, or I love that, that was so funny, or look, the Bullfrogs for Bud Light did this. I don't know what any of that is. And then the second thing about being there at the Super Bowl, which I am every year, David, is that I have no idea what's happening in the stupid halftime show. It's happening in front of you, but it's completely played for the cameras. You know, the people who are on stage, whether it's Beyonce or Coldplay or this year, the glamorous Maroon 5, they're doing it for the TV people at home. They're not doing it for the people who are in the arena. So that's kind of a vacant experience. So it is an odd thing to be present at. And I think that, you know, unlike a lot of things that are, you know, live entertainment, it's really, really built for the TV viewer at home.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of live events are about to start trending that way. Like, did you watch the Taylor Swift concert that they put on Netflix?
Yes, I did. Yes.
I remember watching that, being like, being in the audience for that must have been so strange, with a giant TV crew sort of wandering around on stage as she's looking at it more than she's looking at the audience. And it's like, no, this is a TV product. Everyone there is just extras.
Yeah, no, 100%. And they're so good at it, right? They're so good at sort of not making you aware of the fact that there must be like 5 Steadicam people running around the performer at the time that you're, you know, watching this. And it is probably inhibiting the audience at home's experience. You know, and I think that, you know, once we start getting into, I don't know if you follow technology at all, David, but virtual technology or AR, which stands for augmented reality. Have you ever heard those terms, VR or AR?
No. Is that like a DVD?
It's like an iPhone. Yeah. Well, once those things start to become integrated to our home viewing experience, you know, that thing's going to feel even more radical.
I've never heard of it.
Well, you should read the tech section of the paper. It's good. Good stuff.
But so that's
Walt Mossberg.
That's one of those things I keep hearing about in tech that's going to be a thing like next week, according to everyone, and never according to actual humans. Like, is this a thing in sports that's going to matter anytime soon?
I don't know. Have you actually, and I'm not goofing around here for one second, but have you watched like an NBA game in virtual reality yet?
I have. I watched a chunk of a game, and then I watched, I think it was the dunk contest in VR, and it was gimmicky. Like it felt very cool, but it was hard to imagine spending, you know, 3 hours of my life sort of staring around in circles at this thing.
I'm with you 100%. I haven't watched it in about a year, but a year ago I had the stuff and I watched it, but then I gave it to like an 11-year-old kid to just see what their reaction was. And they just acted like it was completely normal and just immersive and loved it and didn't feel they had to take off the goggles at all. So maybe it's part, you know, getting old and behaviorally I'm going to be hard to adapt. But yeah, I mean, I think that that's the next phase of all of this. And again, you know, not to be just a craven capitalist here, Pierce, but we are the Wall Street Journal. I think this stuff is going to be, you know, valuable for as long as the game is around. And football isn't promised tomorrow with all the head injury stuff and craziness that exists around player health. But as long as the game is around and it's as popular as it is, it's going to be an incredibly valuable property for any tech company. I mean, the other gossip, of course, is just the idea of one of these platforms, whether it's an Amazon or Netflix or Facebook, you know, jumping in and declaring itself, you know, the new home of the NFL, the Super Bowl. And so that doesn't feel terribly far off to me. I think we're going to see that within a decade at least.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And I think what's interesting to me about that is that what I can't decide is if it's Amazon, which already has Thursday Night Football, right? If they get it, and they say, we are now the exclusive home of the Super Bowl. You already subscribed to Prime. It's fine. Would they do the game differently? What, like, it would be on a different place, but I think everybody knows that, and that's fine. But would the game itself change?
It's a really good question. I think that there's going to be a compulsion, you know, just as a technology company to give people something different. But I don't know. We're pretty hardwired as a culture into this kind of two-dimensional viewing experience. And we've seen even, you know, small changes with regard to, you know, remember they put the first down marker, you know, the yellow stripe across the field. And this year NBC was, you know, putting a different shade of green for, you know, the first down territory. You know, people react strongly to even the most subtle changes. But, you know, I'd love to see any type of experimentation. I think the most likely thing is you're going to see like multi-channel options. So you'll have kind of the classic version with, you know, your Tony Romo and Jim Nantz calling the game. And then you might have one that has a couple of players or, you know, hometown favorites or, you know, the option for you and I to do it together at home. You know, anything that, you know, sort of creates a little bit of different buzz, I think they're going to be open to doing because they just have more tools, you know, to use.
Didn't they get, wasn't it Twitch that had Snoop Dogg calling an NHL game this year? Did you see any of that?
I didn't see any of it, but yeah, I mean, people have been doing versions of this. ESPN has been doing it for quite a while with college football. They have that thing where they have a bunch of like nerd coaches in a room breaking down the, you know, all 22, and then you have the you know, hometown announcer for one side and the hometown announcer for the other side. So you have sort of like these biased versions of calling the game that people are, you know, into. So yeah, I just, you know, I think what you'll have is kind of like, you know, we're in a customized world, right, Pierce? Everybody wants everything bespoke to them. So I don't think there's any, you know, reason why broadcast television can't be that way.
Yeah, but isn't that weird? It goes so in the face of everything that we've all talked about makes live sports great, which is it's a thing that's happening at the same time. We all see it sort of the same way.
Yeah, yeah, that's really true. And that's that, you know, and I said sort of a sentence in conflict with itself is like, you know, that's the, you know, why can't like broadcast television be personalized for you? Well, then it stops being broadcast television, right? It becomes something else. And, you know, part of the appeal, as you said, of this stuff is that everybody everywhere is watching it at the same time and in the same manner that you are. And do you diminish something if you're not allowing people to experience it in that way? You know, I don't know. What is your like optimal like sports viewing environment? Because I, you know, I do watch a good deal of television sports at home. You know, I don't always get to go to everything. You know, I usually go to the Super Bowl, David. I don't know if I mentioned that at the top. but I like it quiet. I don't like a lot of people around. I have young kids who I lock in a closet and, you know, bolt the door because I don't want them distracting me. I want to hear what they're saying on TV. You know, I don't need 25 people, you know, drinking Labatt's and jumping up and down.
Yeah, I need, I feel like, a volume control on like the room that I'm in. Because you need the moments where it's like, everybody shut up so I can listen.
Yeah.
And then other times it's like, okay, we can all talk. But during the Super Bowl, I feel like there needs to be a watching the game room and a talking room, and those are separate parties, and that's very important.
That's a great idea. Yeah, I don't want like to go to Buffalo Wild Wings to watch the big game. No offense to Buffalo Wild Wings. You know, the other day I had a very funny viewing experience. As you said, I was in Colorado for the World Fat Bike Championships, you know, the second biggest sporting event in the world after the Super Bowl. And I was in a ski lodge and we were watching, I was in a ski lodge and they had a bunch of televisions on. And in one section of this bar, everybody was watching the X Games and I'm in the corner watching the Warriors and Celtics game. And I just thought it was so funny. Everyone else is watching snowboarding and I'm watching this, like the marginal sport of NBA basketball, or the Colorado marginal sport of NBA basketball. Very strange.
So it's basically, that's who's not watching the Super Bowl, is everybody on mountains.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, there's always people who are trying to counter program it. I think this year, in addition to the Puppy Bowl, and I don't know if you've finished your betting on the Puppy Bowl, but they also have pro wrestling. I think the WWE is doing some sort of cockamamie like wrestling event during the halftime show. So if you're not, you know, on the edge of your seat waiting for Maroon 5, you can watch some oiled up people throw each other around.
Which sounds, to be fair, not all that different from Maroon 5, but
I was about to say, okay. Yeah. Or just what you're having at home, you know?
That's very true. All right. You, I'm sure, have a private jet to catch. So go. And of
if
course, you, does it have a phone
been on
in
the Dow
armrest?
Jones sports jet, you would know that it has phones. Something to aspire to.
What a life. Us lowly tech people over here.
I enjoy being part of this podcast. How are you enjoying having a podcast?
It's lovely. I get to yell into a microphone and hope people listen to it.
Once you get this podcast on the air and you stop doing it at home and you get it on the air for the journal, let me know and I'll come on.
I can't wait. This is good practice. That's our show, everybody. Thanks to Jason, Tripp, and Christopher for being here. No thanks at all to Joanna, who's on vacation. Definite thanks to Tanya Bustos, our producer, who made a lot of technical insanity work this week. And thank you for listening. We have new episodes every Friday, so make sure you subscribe to Instant Message on whatever podcast app you use. I've been using Pandora recently for podcasts, and it's very good, but it doesn't have this podcast, so don't use Pandora. As always, if you have feedback or ideas, email us at personaltech@wsj.com. We'll talk to you soon.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.